You're listening to the ESO Network, your station for all things geek.
Hello, world, and welcome to Tales from Hollywood Land, a veritable feast of movies, Broadway, showbiz stories, news and gossip, with Julia Schlossberg, Arthur E. Friedman, and Stephen J. Rubin. Today, we're talking all about John Wayne with author Scott Iman. And now, here's Julian, Arthur, and Steve.
Welcome, Scott, to our cinema party.
Thank you kindly. Good to be here.
How could we not discuss one of the great icons in film history? My personal favorite actor of all time in terms of volume of movies I love of his. So I'm thrilled to be here. Arthur, you just finished reading Scott's terrific biography of the Duke. Tell us what you felt when you read that book.
Well, I first want to say that we have a beautiful, wonderful library down here by the ocean in Pompano Beach. And I was in there browsing and I took a look and I saw John Wayne. And they had it in big print. I took the book home, curious, of course, being in the movie business for years, would be an interesting read. And it was on my desk for a couple of days, and I took a look, and I opened up in the middle somewhere, and I couldn't stop reading it. It's a great book with research, Scott, that you did that was incredible. John Wayne, to read things about him that, you know, we all know the movies and but what Scott did was very much nail his persona and what he was all about. Scott, as you point out in the book, Cary Grant and Jimmy Stewart and those great, great movie stars of the past are gone. John Wayne lives on. And so that's a really interesting topic for us. And so John Wayne, what got you into it? What made you do this book?
That's an interesting question, and it's not a simple thing. All my books begin with professional admiration. Life's too short to write about people you think are hacks or untalented or a product of publicity rather than talent. I always liked John Wayne, which was not common in my generation because, you know, Vietnam and his politics and everything. He basically alienated almost the entire generation of my generation. I was not hung up about his politics. And so I kind of was like, similar to Peter Bogdanovich in that respect. That said, I wouldn't have written a book about him if I hadn't met him. Because I spent 90 minutes with him alone in a room, and we talked about the movies and about making movies and about how John Ford broke down a scene, all these fairly arcane subjects that he didn't get asked about a lot because this was 1972, and he was America's most famous cancer survivor. And basically the only things people were asking him about in that era were surviving cancer and or conservative politics. And as he told me, politics and I hate politicians. He swore like a sailor, by the way. Not on screen, but off screen. But he was completely different. Not completely different. He was more dimensional than his screen character would lead you to believe he would be. The general rap about Wayne was that he was just projecting his own personality. And there was an element of him that was indeed his own personality that was reflected on in his on-screen performances. But as in conversation, he was much more reflective, much more contemplative, less knee-jerk, more thoughtful, in a word, than his screen character was. His screen character always tended to know where True North was and acted accordingly. And if you tended to disagree with him on screen, you were going to be cast into outer darkness. As a person, he was more interested in having a conversation than a screen character. And I found that very interesting. So I was 21 years old at this point when I met him. And the years go by and I started writing books. And I wrote this big book about John Ford that took me 6 years, in which in retrospect was tough, but I had a lot of material left over, because when you talked about John Ford with people, you automatically, John Wayne would enter the conversation at some point, because they were so closely allied on screen as well as off screen. And then I got to thinking, well, what about John Wayne? And I looked at the literature on John Wayne that had been published, and I frankly thought most of it was junk. So I thought, well, there's an opening there. So I sort of nominated myself. And so I kind of started on second base, because I had so much material that I'd accumulated from writing the Ford book that I hadn't ended up using, because it was about the extended social circle that Ford had around in the field photo service, the World War II unit that Ford had and that Wayne wanted to get into but didn't get into. And I had all this material. And some of the people that I talked to for the Ford book were already dead by the time I started writing the Wayne book, which was in 2009 or 10. The Ford book had come out 10 years earlier in 1999. So time had moved on, and I thought, well, there wasn't a good one-volume book on John Wayne. I might as well do it. So I did it, and the response was, frankly, quite surprising. It was on the New York Times bestseller list for some weeks, which I didn't see coming, and neither did Simon & Schuster. But I guess it was the right book at the right time.
When you interviewed him in 72, did yeah. you record the interview?
Yes, I did. Terrible quality, but good enough to listen to and do a transcript on.
Sure, providing you with terrific firsthand information for the book.
Right.
Now, I've got a question. Casting actors today in our contemporary world, if you want to cast a tough, maybe he's an infantry sergeant or a cowboy or somebody who's good with his fists, physical mm-hmm. actor, more often than not, American producers seem to cast Brits, Aussies, Irish. It seems like Europe has taken over the ranks of the tough guy. And I was wondering your thoughts on, you know, John Wayne came to us in an era which featured men like Richard Burton was British, but Robert Mitchum, William Holden, Broderick Crawford, tough guys. How has things changed in America and from John Wayne's era? Of course, John Wayne epitomized the guy you would want on your back if you were in a fight.
Oh, I suppose you could make gross generalizations about America being more socialized, shall we say, than Europe. Also, you have more disparate cultures in Europe, you know, because the French culture is completely different from the German culture, which is in turn completely different from the Russian culture, you know, or the Italian culture. There's not that much commonality between European ideas of masculinity. You know, Elaine Delon and is not Marcello Mastroianni, and Yves Montand is not Burt Lancaster. So it's a more disparate group of cultures, and the filmmaking cultures are also quite different. Not just ideas of masculinity and femininity, but the actual filmmaking cultures are quite different. I mean, there's more government subsidies, for instance, in filmmaking. Government subsidies are practically unknown in American film. So it's just a completely different concept of masculinity and femininity, and it remains so. America seems to me to be more prone to socialization and what's the latest trend. And we have to remake ourselves depending upon what the prevailing trends are. And I don't think Europe is anywhere near as much prone to that. You know,
where would John Wayne be today? Do you if let's say he was 50 or 60 years old and everything is going on that's going on, what would he be like? What position do you think he'd have without getting into definitive politics or anything like that?
Well, I think his politics would be the same. I don't think his politics would have shifted an iota. Because he's born in 1907. So he'd be extremely elderly.
But his views were extreme in those days.
They were extreme in those days. They're less extreme now. There's a lot more people espousing basically what John Wayne was espousing 50 years ago than were at the time, 50 years. Yeah. He was an outlier at the time, which just goes to show you how American social attitudes shift over time.
I'm kind of interested in talking to you, Scott, about Stagecoach and Long Voyage Home,
yeah,
because for 25 years I was the exclusive distributor of both movies.
Right.
And very proud to have both those films, even though, as we both know, Long Voyage Home was not a commercial success.
No, certainly not.
No. But what I want to ask is this. When you did your book on Ford and also on Wayne, how extensive did you go into the difficulty of John Ford getting the okay for John Wayne to be the star of that movie?
Of Stagecoach? Well, coming off Stagecoach, Wayne was much hotter than he had been before Stagecoach, because it's Stagecoach. When Ford wanted him to do Stagecoach, Wayne was under contract to Republic, grinding out 10-day westerns, and that's all he was doing. And he was regarded as damaged goods, because even at the time in 1939, but even after 1939, nobody escaped from B westerns. If you were doing B westerns, you were doing time in Alcatraz for the rest of your career. Nobody got out of that. Tim Holt didn't. Tim Holt made a few pictures. He made Ambersons and Treasure of the Sierra Madre, but then he went trundling back to making B-Westerns. Johnny Mack Brown, all those B-Western guys, they were doing B-Westerns until B-Westerns died or until they got too fat to get on a horse.
Yeah.
So that Ford wanting Wayne to do Stagecoach, the script was excellent. Ford had already was already an A-list director regarded as an artist. And Wanger was perfectly happy to finance the film, and Selznick would have been perfectly happy to finance the film. But nobody really wanted John Wayne headlining that cast, because he had the mark of Cain on him. He was a B-Western actor, and that was low rent. And this was an A-Western, you know?
And a lot of people have no idea that Claire Trevor gets top billing, not John Wayne.
She does, and she gets more close-ups than John Wayne, too.
Well, the first thing that really caught my attention about Scott's writing was his description, your description, Scott, of Stagecoach and that shot that Ford gets coming in on Wayne and the sawed-off shotgun. And that is about as iconic a shot as there's ever been.
Yeah.
But from that point on, I mean, your writing is brilliant. I just couldn't put the book down. You know, as Julian says, he did distribute the picture subsequent to its initial run, but that was a pretty successful film and made him a star.
It was a very successful film. It did make him a star. And he immediately became Republic's most valuable commodity. And it made him it made him viable for the rest of Hollywood that wouldn't have looked at him twice, because he was just making 10-day westerns at Republic, which is why I think probably he helped get Long Voyage Home financed. It didn't work out, but Wanger, after Stagecoach, was happy to finance Wayne and Ford in another picture. So he did, and he promptly lost the money that he'd made on Stagecoach. But that's the movie business.
Tell us.
How did you get to see and get to be with John Wayne? I mean, you must have known someone, or how did it happen?
I didn't know anybody. I was 21 years old. I was in Cleveland, Ohio, where I was born. And I wanted to write about the movies, and I thought I could write, but I wasn't sure. Nobody's ever sure. I'm still working on the surety part. And I figured, well, if I'm going to write about the movies and I'm in Ohio, I have to do something I have to meet people, and there's no way I can meet anybody in Ohio. But I was doing freelance writing, and I would interview people that passed through Cleveland promoting this or that or the other thing. So I got a chance to hang out with John Carradine and Buddy Rogers, and whoever came through, I would sidle up to and spend the day with. And it was a lot of fun. But ultimately, I had to do something about getting to Hollywood. So without knowing quite what I was getting into, I figured, well, I might as well start at the top. And after I get rejected at the top, I'll just work my way down. So I wrote a letter to John Wayne, off the care of Paramount Pictures, where his office was. And didn't expect anything. So 8-10 days later, I got a letter back from his secretary saying, well, if you're ever out here, call me and I'll try to hook you up. So I promptly booked my first trip to Los Angeles.
Yeah.
And I gave myself like 3 or 4 weeks out. And then I started madly writing letters to other people I wanted to talk to. William Wellman, Bill Clothier, James Wong Howe, Henry Hathaway, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So I got out there and I called John Wayne's secretary, who had written me the letter, a sainted woman named Mary St. John, who I always revere. And I called her and she said, oh, sure, I remember you. And there's a moment where I can hear her flipping through pages of a calendar. And she said, well, on Thursday, he's at CBS taping a TV show. Could you get over there? Now, I was staying in a motel, and I didn't have enough money for a rental car. But I said, sure. So I took cabs everywhere I had to go because I didn't have the money to rent a car. So I just said yes whenever someone said, well, can you meet me here? Can you meet me there? I just said yes. I took a cab. So I took the cab to a Studio City. It was one of these all-star tributes thing. It was a CBS's salute to CBS, CBS's 50th anniversary. So Bob Hope was there. Jack Benny was there. Milton Berle was there. Lucille Ball was there. None of them were there at the same time. They were all like in 2-hour increments. They'd get made up. They'd come in, they'd tape their bit, and they'd leave, you know. So it was one of those all-star things, self-congratulatory. And I heard meet John Wayne, and they checked my name. Yeah, took me back. I waited outside his dressing room. After about 5 minutes, the door opened, and they waved me in. And he was sitting there looking at himself in a makeup mirror. His toupee was on. His tuxedo shirt was on. The jacket was not on. And he was smoking, and this surprised me, he was smoking a little cigar about yay long. Little black cigar like Clint Eastwood smoked in the Leone Westerns. Now, at this point, he's America's most famous cancer survivor, and he's doing cancer ads on television. So I had no idea that he was such a tobacco addict. He was still smoking, but he was, and he never really stopped. In spite of the fact he'd already lost a lung, he was still smoking. But he stood up, we shook hands, he was huge. He was just huge. 6'4", probably 250, 260. Big, I mean, broad, and narrow hips. I mean, he was shaped like a triangle. Even though he was older at this point, he would have been 65 here. And he had a lot of weight on him. He still had narrow hips. His hips were much narrower than his shoulders. And he was very imposing. Black dress shoes, eye gloss. And I was nervous for about 2 minutes. And then he put me at ease. And he did that by speaking very quietly. And by he contrived to make himself smaller. And I'm sure this was something he did all the time. Because he was so large in both popular culture and in person that people could be easily intimidated by it. So he had to figure out a way to make people relax, as actors do. And what he did was he contrived to make himself smaller in the chair. He sort of leaned back and kind of wrapped one arm around the other arm and made himself as small as this guy who's 6'4" and 250 pounds could make himself. And we started talking about movies, and I didn't ask him about cancer, and I didn't ask him about politics. I remember one question I asked him, which he brightened up at immediately, and this was early. How did John Ford break down a scene into shots? You got a scene, you're coming on the set at 8 a.m, you're starting the scene. How did Ford break a scene down into individual shots that coalesced when they were all cut together? And he just, well, and he went off into a 5-minute thing, basically telling me that Ford would have they had their lines. The actors all had their lines. The actors, he would ask the actors to walk through the scene as they felt the scene. And they'd walk through the scene as they felt it, crossing over here, over there, sitting down, standing up, whatever. And then they'd finish, and he'd say, okay, now, on your line there, can you cross? And if the camera's here, could you cross down towards the camera and then cross over here? Because if you can do that, I don't have to cut. And if I don't have to cut, I'm a happy man. And they'd say, sure, Pappy, we can do that. So he said it was very organic. He didn't use the word organic. He said it felt very natural. He didn't force you into movements that weren't comfortable for the sake of his shot. He figured out a way to make his shot look good and make you feel good at the same time. And we were off. Because I knew instinctively that no one asked him these kinds of questions, you know? Yeah. He was used to getting a very set group of questions. And what I didn't know Now, why am I sitting there in the first place? Why did he agree to see me? What I didn't know was he hated to be alone. One of the reasons he loved making movies was there's 100 people around making the movie. There's the stuntman. There's the makeup guys. There's the grips. There's the camera crew. There's all these people. And someone is going to be able to give you a good chess game on a film set between shots. There's always going to be a couple people who can play chess. And he didn't want to be alone. He didn't want to be sitting there with nobody talking to him because he was very gregarious by nature. And he didn't like to be by himself in hotel rooms. He wanted people around him. He wanted people he could play chess with. He wanted people he could chew the rag with. So one of Mary St. John's issues, one of her job functions, was to figure out people that he could talk to.
So and you qualified. And you qualified.
Yeah. It was comparatively easy to get someone in there if he wasn't heavily booked. And he was shooting this thing, and of course it took longer than they thought it was going to do Milton Berle, who was shooting before John Wayne. So I had him all by myself. I was probably scheduled for a half hour. I had him for 90 minutes. So I ran through all my questions, and we still kept talking. And he only got upset once. I asked him about John Huston, with whom he made a perfectly awful picture called The Barbarian and the Geisha. And he went off. I never thought Huston was all that good. Other than The Maltese Falcon and The Treasure of the Sierra Madre, I never thought he was that good. And frankly, I think his father had more to do with John Huston being successful with those two pictures than John Huston did. And he continued talking in that vein, and he started to get angry talking about Huston, how Huston had blown the picture off and hadn't been attentive during the movie. And he starts to get, I can only compare it to a locomotive building up steam. He's like starting to get breathing heavy. He's breathing harder and breathing heavier. And I'm thinking, oh, fuck, I'm making John Wayne angry. Well, we all know what happens to people that make John Wayne angry. I didn't want to make John Wayne angry because we were getting along fine. So I just quickly got off the subject of John Huston. But he had a real hard on about John Huston. And obviously John Huston made a lot of wonderful pictures where Walter Huston was either had nothing to do with or was long dead. So Huston's talent went a lot deeper than having his old man around. But as far as Wayne was concerned, Huston poisoned the well on The Barbarian and the Geisha. And he didn't want to hear anything good about John Huston. So we moved on to other people.
Scott, had the
article in Playboy been either discussed or did he bring it up where he was quoted and getting his head whacked around on?
I did not bring it up. He brought it up peripherally. He didn't refer to it directly, but he said people, you know, he was criticized for some of the things he'd said and he kind of obliquely referred to it. I didn't follow up on it because I wanted to talk to him about the movie business. He loved to talk about the movie business. If you asked him a question of like, how did John Ford break down a scene into shots? I asked him about Nat Levine, a kind of shyster operator who ran Mascot Pictures, a very early Poverty Row outfit in the 30s that was later absorbed into Republic. And he made three serials for Nat Levine. And Nat Levine would shoot an entire 4 hours of film in 20 days, 18 days. And Wayne got, I think, $750 for the serials. Not a week, for the entire serial. Yeah. But there's a depression on, and he's got a couple kids. And $750 is better than not working at all. So he took the money. And he went off. Oh, his face brightened up, and he started telling Nat Levine stories, which were very funny. And how much the stuntmen hated Nat Levine because he wouldn't pay stuntmen what the going rate was, whatever the going rate was in 1932, 33. And so the stuntman would plot to stick a ring off Nat Levine's finger because he had a big pinky ring on his finger and they wanted to steal the ring. And Nat Levine put up such a fight that, you know, the stuntman got bruised. Very funny showbiz movie backlot stories.
Did you?
Nobody ever asked him about.
Did you get a chance to ask him if he had a favorite of his 140 plus feature films?
He named one of his son. He named his last son Ethan, after Ethan Edwards in The Searchers.
Versus, yeah,
that was a favorite. He liked She Wore a Yellow Ribbon because it gave him a chance to act, as opposed to punch people. where he's playing a guy who's 60 years old. And how old is he? And he's 40. He was 40, 42 at the time he made it. And he's playing a 60, 65-year-old man. So you get a chance to act. He liked Red River, of course. He liked the pictures everybody else liked.
He's got Red River is probably one of the greatest movies I've ever seen, regardless of being Western. What a great movie that was. I want to mention to you, he had a close friend of his who was a friend of mine as well, a movie theater owner in Philadelphia named Mert Shapiro. And Mert invited me to have drinks with him and Duke at the Polo Lounge. And Andy McLaughlin was there at the time. I sat down and enjoyed, you know, Howard must stay there for about an hour. And I came away looking at this man thinking, that's the same guy that's on the screen. I mean, he was as down to earth and regular as one could possibly be. Very likable.
He was very he was immensely likable. The difference was he wasn't quite as dogmatic, except if you brought up certain things. His screen character was more my way or the highway than I found him personally. You know, he wanted to hear what you thought, even if you were talking about politics. And I didn't really go into politics, but I could sense he was interested in the give and take, the back and forth of a conversation. He wasn't necessarily going to impose himself on someone unless they pissed him off.
There's been a lot of Native American news in the movie business of late because of the Scorsese film. And one of the things I had read at one point, I can't remember where, that somebody was complaining that John Wayne was a racist and that he hated Native Americans, which I could not believe for a second. Now, granted, he did not write the Cavalry trilogy, but if ever there was a way of presenting Native Americans in a dignified way, it was in the Cavalry trilogy. In your research, what do you think his relationship was with Native Americans?
Well, the Native American tribe he was familiar with were the Navajos in Monument Valley. And to this day, the Navajos like John Wayne, and they revere those films, partially because when they look at them, they see their great-grandfather or grandfather, you know, riding their horses. I don't think you can superimpose the racial politics of 1945 on the racial politics of 2020. I think that's foolish to begin with. I never quite understood why someone who's born in the Edwardian era is supposed to replicate our racial and sexual attitudes. I just don't see why we expect that of anybody. Do they really think that people born in 100 years are going to have our racial and sexual attitudes?
Of course not.
No, they're going to regard us as barbarians.
No.
That's just the way, that's the way social progress. You know, you go forward 6 inches, you go back 4 inches, forward, back, forward, back. Anyway.
I was interested in the fact that I guess in a way politics did get in his way as far as choosing roles. If I'm correct, Scott, and please let me know if I am, he turned down both High Noon and All the King's Men. Isn't that true?
He did turn down High Noon. Yeah, he didn't want to do High Noon. I don't know about All the King's Men. I don't see him in that part, frankly.
No.
I mean, he was a big movie star in 1949, 1950. So a lot of things would have been passed by him. But I think he would have been terribly miscast in all as Willie Stark. I really do. High Noon, he certainly could have played. And he wouldn't have played it. But Hawks was upset about it. Wayne was upset about it because in Wayne's mind, that Gary Cooper grinds the badge into the ground at the end of the movie, which he doesn't do, but he just throws the badge in the ground and walks over it and gets in the buckboard with Grace Kelly. Who could blame him? But they took that as a rejection of the sheriff's social duty. He's only doing what he's supposed to do, you know, in the picture. What's the big deal? That's his job. Why is this such a heroic thing? And of course, Hawks ended up making Rio Bravo with Wayne, where basically it's Wayne, a drunk and a half crazy old man holding off the town, you know, all by themselves. Okay. They're both wonderful movies. High Noon's a wonderful movie, but High Noon's also a socio-political tract. There's no way to look at High Noon and not know this is about more than a Gary Cooper Western, you know? It's overt if you know anything at all about what was going on in America, and if you knew what was going on with Carl Foreman getting blacklisted, et cetera. It's an obvious parable. And High Noon is a response to that parable from a conservative point of view, because both Hawks and Wayne were political conservatives. So, okay, turnabout's fair play.
It would be interesting if he had turned down, if it's true, all the King's Men, because he got nominated that year for Sands of Iwo Jima.
Yeah.
And he lost to Broderick Crawford,
yeah,
who did win the Academy Award. I agree with you. It seems strange that Willie Stark would be John Wayne, but, you know, they try to make movies.
Well, that's a Pulitzer Prize winning novel, but I don't think Harry Cohn was thrilled with the idea of making it. Robert Rawson was, and I frankly, Broderick Crawford having an Academy Award, as I think he's a coarse, vulgar actor who bellowed his way through every part he ever played.
He was Broderick Crawford.
He was Broderick Crawford. Yeah, he was not a finesse actor. Let's let it go at that. But it was a good part, and it's a good picture. I don't think it's a great picture by any stretch of the imagination. I would rather have seen Wayne get an Oscar for Red River.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, speaking, but
it wasn't the same year.
I think that Wayne disliked Harry Cohn a lot, didn't he?
He hated Harry Cohn.
Yeah.
He talked about Harry
Cohn. He was part of a big club.
But he really objected to Harry Cohn because he had made a B Western at Columbia supporting Buck Jones, speaking of guys who never got out of B Westerns. And I think Wayne was third billed. And this is before he hooked up at Republic. This is the mascot era where Wayne is working at Mascot. And he got a job at Columbia working with Buck Jones. And Cohn accused Wayne of having a relationship with an actress that Cohn was interested in having a relationship with. And as Wayne said, it was a goddamn lie. Now, Wayne was married at this point. And the marriage was very solid and the kids were starting to come. And he was really, really offended by being accused by Harry Cohn of having an affair with an actress, when he wasn't that kind of guy. And if you look at the opportunities he had and versus the affairs he had, you can count the affairs on two or three fingers. He was not a guy to sleep around. He really wasn't.
And then he said,
and I haven't worked for Columbia since, and I had plenty of opportunities, believe me. So Harry Cohn is on his personal blacklist, as far as that went. And even after Harry Cohn died, he never made a picture of Columbia. Never. And there were plenty of pictures of Columbia that he could have done and made a lot of money.
I wonder if he was offered the Burt Lancaster role in From Here to Eternity. That would have been an interesting role for him.
It could have played. Yeah, he could have. And I mean, Randolph Scott's career would have been a lot of different if Wayne had set up Fat Jack at Columbia, for instance, you know.
But from your book, Scott, he had a very specific kind of woman that he seemed to like. And I thought the relationship with him and Pilar was unusual to read about. I didn't think it would be that way. That he
liked Latin women. All his wives were Latin.
Yes. Yeah.
That was a thing, obviously.
But that he would dominate him was surprising to me. I would think.
Oh, it wasn't surprising.
Opposite way around. Yeah.
Speaking of interesting castings, if I had to be a fly on the wall in any casting session in the history of Hollywood, I would have liked to have been a fly on the wall when they were casting The Conqueror, where they had to cast Genghis Khan. Now, the joke over the years is they were making an Eastern instead of a Western.
Yeah.
How the hell did John Wayne get into that movie?
He and Howard Hughes, he had a contract with Howard Hughes and he owed Hughes a picture. And he and Hughes were bound by politics. Okay. But he'd been off and on at RKO since 1940, 41. And when Hughes bought the company after the war, Hughes signed him up to do some pictures. And I mean, the Argosy pictures, She Wore Yellow Ribbon and Fort Apache were released through RKO. So he was used to working for Hughes. and they got along okay, as much as anybody could get along okay with Howard Hughes. So, and he owed him a movie. And if you read the book, there's this wonderful letters from Wayne to Hughes, basically yelling at him on paper for not coming up with his side of the contractual agreements, that Wayne had only a certain number of weeks available that he could go to work for RKO, because he's working, he's in demand by Ford, he's in demand by Hawks, he's got his own production company by that time. So his time is limited. And Hughes simply won't come up with any kind of acceptable script, because Howard Hughes was not really interested in making movies. He was in it for ancillary personal reasons. So finally, they did this jet pilot thing, which started shooting, I think, in 1949 and comes out in 1957, because Hughes was playing with it literally for 6-7 years, adding footage, reshooting footage, recutting, watching it in the screening room, getting off on whatever he was getting off on. And then finally, the last commitment that they had was this picture that came in. I think Wayne was frankly just glad to get it off his table, get Hughes off his table, because RKO by that time in 1956, 57, or 55, is a failing operation. And everybody knows it's a failing operation in Hollywood. And the money was laying on the table. Fine, just let me out. Just give it to me and let me get this over with. Terrible picture. The script is bad. Wayne's bad. Susan Hayward's terrible. Everybody's at the worst.
We now know that they filmed on rather tainted ground, which had been part of the nuclear test. So do you ascribe to the theory that all the people who got cancer may have gotten it from working on that location?
Is it possible? Yeah, sure, it's possible. On the other hand, how many of these people were heavy smokers?
Right.
Wayne was a 4 or 5-pack-a-day guy. He was smoking little black cigars when I was with him. But he thought that was his compromise by not smoking cigarettes. It was okay to smoke cigars instead of cigarettes. But he would light one cigarette off the, and he smoked Camels, for God's sakes, unfiltered Camels. My grandfather smoked unfiltered Camels. My grandfather dropped dead at 70. But he would light one off the butt of another one. You know, I mean, it was continual with him. He was a heavy, heavy smoker. So is it possible that the locate, and how long are they on location for the picture? 3 weeks?
Well, if you have 200 people, if you have 200 people in cast and crew and yeah. 91 of them end up with cancer, I would say it's a good shot.
Is that a legitimate number? Oh, I mean, did really 91 out of 200 people?
That's what we read. Now, whether it's valid, I didn't go around and check. But we cannot leave this without talking about True Grit, because, I mean, there's a whole change in even people who didn't like John Wayne. Did he mention it? Did you talk about it? Where were you with that? Do you remember?
Actually, we didn't talk about True Grit, although he liked Hathaway a lot. Hathaway was a screamer. Henry Hathaway was a screamer. And I knew Henry Hathaway. And he was the most courteous, quiet gentleman in his living room. But everybody you talked to who worked with him, Roddy McDowell told me, leaned over and said, I saw Henry Hathaway make Dean Martin cry.
Mm-hmm.
Now, can you imagine Dean Martin crying? I cannot. But Henry Hathaway made Dean Martin cry. He screamed at him with such venom.
I think Jerry Lewis made him cry a couple times too, out of boredom.
Ultimately, though, Dean Martin made Jerry Lewis cry.
Yes,
I think. But no, he left Henry. Wayne's the only thing Wayne said about Hathaway to me was Henry doesn't deal as much with script as Ford and Hawks does. Which is a nice way of saying that Hathaway could direct a very good script extremely well. But he was not necessarily a good judge of what made a good script, which is where Hal Wallace comes in on True Grit, because Hal Wallace was a really good producer and made very few terrible movies. And True Grit's a very good script, and Hathaway does a very good job directing it. And Wayne's wonderful. I think it's a very good picture. And people always say, well, he got a job for self-parody in True Grit. I don't think it's self-parody. I think it's a very enjoyable, big, roistering, larger-than-life performance, which is what the film needs.
It certainly did, and I totally agree with you. Didn't Wayne try to buy the rights for that?
Yes, he did. He got outbid by Al Wallace, and it really pissed him off. Really pissed him off. And Wallace had some had to seduce Wayne. They ended up giving him a piece of the copyright, a larger, not just a piece of the gross. He owned a piece of the copyright.
Oh.
Speaking of, as I say, the research you did for the book, The Life, John Wayne, The Life and Legend, is great. You get into the budgets of a lot of these movies, and that's, you know, interesting to say the least, especially for people in the film business.
Sure.
But I was taken by the fact that Wayne was making like only $3,000 a movie beyond Stagecoach until he found Charlie Feldman. And Charlie Feldman opened up this world of 50 grand and all the rest.
And a percentage. Sure.
And a percentage, yes.
Yes. Wayne was in some ways an innocent, you know. He stayed with Republic for years and years and years because he felt a loyalty.
Yeah, you wrote about that.
Because Herb Yates had hired him when no one else would hire him, and it paid him $350 a week. And in 1935, 36, that's not terrible money for B Westerns. That's okay money. And you're getting 40 weeks. So, and he had three kids. So he always had a kind of blue collar mentality, you know. He hired me when nobody else would. Therefore, I owe him. Even though he'd moved far beyond Yates's capabilities as a producer and ability to mount stuff. And then he made a terrible mistake and got Ford to come over to Republic. And used his leverage with Ford to get him to come over to Republic so Ford could make The Quiet Man. And then Yates proceeded to screw Ford over on the profits from The Quiet Man, whereupon Ford blamed Wayne for the rest of his life. It was just another thing that he could harass Wayne about in their slightly abusive father-son relationship. You know, yeah, you brought me over to Columbia. I'm brought me over to Republic and Yates fucked me. That kind of thing, you know.
Over the years, the perception has been that when Wayne made The Alamo in 1960, lost a good deal of his fortune. Is that considering over the years, I'm sure the movie made money, but was it a big financial problem for him at the time?
It was because he made a bad deal. As he said, I made a bad goddamn deal to me. That's what he said. I made a bad goddamn deal. What he did was, he made a deal with UA, but UA wouldn't fully finance the picture. I don't have the numbers in front of me. It was something, they gave him like $3 or $4 million. Well, he couldn't make the picture for $3 or $4 million. It was impossible. So he dropped in the money he had, which was another $1.5 million to $2 million. And he still didn't have enough money to make the picture. So he had to look for independent money, which was Texas oil money. So he got the money he needed to make the picture, but they saw him coming. The independent oil money. So they arranged their contracts so they got first dollars. And UA was taking their money also off the distribution percentage from first dollar. So Wayne was in the position of last money. And the picture did okay, but it didn't make enough money. It paid off the independent money that Wayne had contracted with, and it paid off UA. But it didn't pay off Wayne. So because he was in last position on the profits and it didn't make quite enough profits, he lost his personal investment, which meant that he had to start all over again as a producer. And he'd made a fair amount of money with Wayne Fellows Productions. He'd made Hondo. He made The High and the Mighty. These were very big pictures. They made a lot of High and the Mighty was a huge picture. And Hondo was extremely successful. And all this money, and he also made some pictures that weren't terribly successful. But the profits he had all went into the Alamo, and he lost it. So he had to start all over again. And that's when he clicks into Atari, making Atari. He signed an 8-picture deal with Paramount to get some income coming.
Steve, Scott writes extensively about this, this whole, all these things in this. It's a great book. And also that one of his sons, was it Patrick or Michael? I forget, who takes over the business of his company. Michael. Very smart.
Michael ran Bat Jack. Michael was a smart guy.
Yeah.
Michael was a smart guy. Michael took a look himself in the mirror and realized he wasn't going to be a movie star.
Sadly, amongst the film preservationists, apparently the negative of The Alamo is in very bad shape. It's one of those movies that desperately somebody needs to come in like the cavalry and rescue the movie.
The problem is there was one 70mm print, the complete version, the 212 minutes, I think the complete version was, 3.5 hour, 3 hour, 40 minute version. Only one, the negative, Wayne sold the picture to UA, finally, to get the debt off his back. He sold the picture to UA after it was reissued in his 7 or 8 years after 1960. And then he sold the picture to UA because he just needed to get the debt off his back. The picture had been cut for general release from 200 some minutes to 160 something. The only print of the complete uncut version was a 70mm original release print from 1960, which has deteriorated and turned red. Now, you can fix it. You can fix the color, but you can't fix the fact that the print itself has deteriorated. And the negative, wherever the negative of the 70mm uncut version was, nobody knows. So it's somewhere. It got lost. And so I don't know that the original 200 minute version could be restored. I think it might be impossible at this point. So all there is nice material on the short version, which is like 40 minutes shorter.
Scott, in your original interview with the Duke, did he mention any actors that he was particularly fond of? Obviously he had the guys in the Ford Stock Company, I'm sure were all friends of his, but right. Were there any actors that he admired particularly that he may have mentioned?
We talked mostly about the Ford Stock Company. He loved Ward Bond, because Ward was like the class clown, you know, the butt of all the jokes. Because Ward, and the odd thing is, Ward Bond's a wonderful actor, but all the stories everybody told, he was not the most self-aware human being on earth by any stretch of the imagination, or even smart particularly. But on screen, he's fine. They just loved Ward because he was such a joyous personality and kind of. A big overgrown kid.
But Scott, if Ward Bond was a baseball player, his batting average for hits would be about 800. This guy made hits.
Well, he was a great character actor. He made 4 or 5 pictures a year. You could do that in that era because the volume of production was so high. And he was always like billed 5th or 6th, but he always had great little scenes. I just watched him in Gentleman Jim. Probably the best.
Great.
Great performance as John L. Sullivan. It's very touching.
That's a wonderful movie, period. But it's interesting that they went back to USC and the football team. Both Ward Bond and Marion at that point, yes. I guess.
Marion Morris.
Were playing football together. So that's a long friendship for anyone to have.
He loved Harry Carey, didn't he?
He loved Harry Carey Sr.
And
he loved Harry Carey Jr.
Yeah.
He loved Dobie. I loved Dobie was a friend. I loved Dobie. Everybody loved Dobie. I don't think Dobie had an enemy in the world.
By the way, Scott, I'm sorry to interrupt. How did Harry Carey Jr. get the nickname Dobie? Do you know?
Yeah, his hair. His hair was the color of Adobe bricks.
Oh, okay.
Kind of dirty blonde. It was a dirty blonde. And that reddish dirty blonde. And that's where it came from, Adobe. And it got shortened to Dobie.
Scott, did you see the movie Trumbo?
Yeah.
And what do you think of the way Wayne was treated in that?
I wouldn't want to be the actor that has to play John Wayne. It was all right. I didn't mind. I thought everybody was acting big, including Bryan Cranston playing Trumbo. Yeah. Trumbo was a theatrical character. I don't know if he was quite as big a character as Bryan Cranston played, though.
But they showed the Wayne to be not very nice. And
Yeah. Well, that's fair.
Yeah,
that's fair. He wasn't at his best, shall we say, in that period. You know, he threw his weight around. By that time, he had weight, and by that time, he threw it around.
I have a friend who went to one of AFI tributes. I think it might have been the John Ford one, and they where he was a page standing in the back of the hall watching all these celebrities and escorting them into the house. And he wanted to watch the show, and the guards were about to take him out. John Wayne comes over and basically says, "Why don't you leave the kid alone?" And my
friend will never forget it. That was good, Steve. That was very good. That was good.
That sounds like him, actually.
Thank you. Well, I've seen probably some of his movies probably over 100 times. Scott, do you have a favorite film of his filmography?
The modern favorite is The Searchers. I kind of have a yen for Liberty Valance.
How well do you know?
Although, to be honest, my favorite Ford Western is My Darling Clementine. It's not John Wayne's not in
not
my
John
darling.
Wayne.
No, John Wayne. How well?
But if I had to watch one Ford Western, it would be My Darling Clementine.
How well do you know Liberty Valance?
Very well.
Okay, so I've watched it 100 times. There's a scene where Jimmy Stewart is instructing in his little classroom behind the print shop, and he asks Pompey, the wonderful Woody Strode character, to describe what this dialogue comes from, which obviously comes from the Constitution. He says, you know, it's affected by amendments. And yet, and excuse me for this arcane moment, guys, Jimmy Stewart says, no, that's the Declaration of Independence, which is obviously wrong. How could that possibly happen in a Ford film like that? Or was it just a continuity issue or something, dialogue replacement?
I don't remember if it's dubbed. I don't remember if the line's dubbed. It could have been Ford just being perverse. Okay. Ford was perfectly capable of being perverse, just to startle people or make an actor uncomfortable. And if Jimmy Stewart said, "But that's not in that's from the Constitution, not the Declaration," but Ford would say it, say the line, say it as written.
Yeah,
you know, everybody would say it as written because he's John Ford, and because everybody was scared of him.
Interesting thing about Liberty Valance, at that time I was in the music business and friendly with a guy named Gene Pitney, who was a very popular singer in those days. And he
recorded a good song, Burt Bacharach song.
There it is.
Man,
Liberty Valance had a big hit. But it came after the movie, is that right?
No, it was supposed to be on this under the credits, but Ford didn't want it under the credits.
Right.
So the film, the song was issued basically simultaneously, and I'm sure it helped cross-plugging. But it wasn't on the film itself because he felt the song was too up-tempo and too bop, 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 because the film is very mellow and very depressing and very morose, actually.
Yes, it was morose, but the song was a hit and probably cross-pollinated into the movie.
I had a friend of mine, the late writer-producer named John Sackrett Young, who did China Beach and West Wing, a lot of great shows. And he was a big John Ford guy. And he and I would always have these long, and they were all circular debates because we always came around the same point. He didn't like Liberty Valance because he thought it looked like an episode of Gunsmoke, which it does. And he thought he was offended by the cheapness of it, the physicality of it, which you expect with Ford. You expect the wind, you expect a sense of the landscape, and there's nothing like that. And he said, and that last shot. I know of the train after you know, old Jimmy Stewart and old Vera Miles in the train. And then there's a handheld shot of the train. He said, "I don't know where that shot came from. I don't know where that shot came from." Fade out. John Sackrett Young, my friend, dies a couple of years ago. I'm watching Tales of Wells Fargo on the Western Channel. And there, at the end credits of the Tales of Wells Fargo with Dale Robertson, is that same handheld shot of the train disappearing around a curve with high grasses. And it's a handheld shot, so there's a slight shakiness to it. And I thought, John, where are you? You're right. They just bought the shot from Universal.
Took it.
To splice onto the end of the film. Because Ford wouldn't go on location to shoot a shot of a train disappearing over the horizon. They just bought 100 feet of film from Universal, you know? But John really objected to that, the cheapness of it. It's not cheap. It cost $3 million. But that was $750,000 for Wayne. That was $500,000 for Jimmy Stewart. Mm. That was Ford's salary. A lot of it was overhead. You know, there wasn't a lot left to make the movie after they paid everybody.
So we're coming to the end of our show. I'd like to ask you, Scott, what are you applying your considerable research efforts to these days?
Well, my Charlie Chaplin versus America came out in October, the end of October. And normally I take 7 or 8 months off between books to let the batteries charge. But as I've gotten older, I take off less and less time because I have less and less time to write. Actually, I just started another project a couple months ago. It's something different. It's about a woman because I've only written about one other woman in my roster of books, and I'm long, long overdue to write about a woman. But it's not Katharine Hepburn, and it's not Audrey Hepburn, and it's not Betty Davis, I can assure you.
Right.
I'm sick to death of all three of them.
Speaking of women, given her notorious reclusiveness, were you able to reach out to Vera Miles on your book on Wayne?
I tried. No answer.
Yeah, I had the same problem. It's just too bad because I'm sure she has a lot of great stories.
Oh, God. That's a major career. She didn't get major attention, but she worked for, she worked for God, Hitchcock, Ford. Ford liked her, you know, clearly. She worked for a lot of major people. It's too bad. I've got to tell you,
I've known three people in my life that slept with Marlene Dietrich. One of them was Eddie Fisher. Eddie Fisher told me she was like the greatest thing that ever happened to him.
Oh yeah.
And I noticed in your book that John Wayne thought the same thing too.
Yeah, she was one of his few extramarital escapades. One of his few. And I gather she turned him every which way but loose.
Yes, he loved it.
Would have had to make it worthwhile because he was not a guy that, you know, tried to nail his co-stars. He really wasn't.
Yeah. But she was.
She was. Yeah, he was. He went far, far off the reservation for her. Yeah.
I'd like to just say before we leave.
Well, they made three pictures together consecutively. I mean, clearly you don't make three pictures in a row with somebody unless you're really either crazy in love with them, or they're just the greatest talent on the face.
Yeah, it worked. I want to mention a movie we haven't talked about called North to Alaska. I thought it was great. Loved the movie. Just fun, entertaining. But how Wayne got involved with the young singing talents, Fabian, Frankie Avalon, Glenn.
Ricky Nelson.
Ricky Nelson
in Rio Grande.
That's when he starts. That's actually, I think Ricky Nelson was the first. But that's when he started thinking about that kind of thing, because he was aware that he was getting older and that he appealed to people of his own generation. And he thought that using Frankie Avalon in the Alamo, because North to Alaska was a very big commercial success.
Yes.
Even though he didn't produce it, it made a lot of money. And I believe he had a percentage. And that was Fabian, a kind of second string Elvis. So he began to think like that. So even into the 70s, Bobby Vinton shows up in Big Jake for no particular reason, but Bobby Vinton had a few hit records 5 years earlier.
Polish Prince.
Yeah, the Polish Prince. So he started to think kind of programmatically, like, how do I broaden my base, you know, so I can get some young people in? And Glenn Campbell in True Grit, another classic example. Now, that was a Hal Wallace production, but I'm sure Wayne said, that's a great idea, you know. Because you don't want to just get one component of the audience. You want to get as many audience components in as you possibly can. You know, because he didn't think of himself as making art movies. He thought of himself as being a commercial entertainer. And he wanted the films to be widely seen.
Well, this has been terrific, Scott. We definitely want to have you back for one of your other books. You've been listening to Tales from Hollywoodland. We're on all the podcast platforms, Apple, Amazon, Spotify. If you'd like to get in touch with us, please write to us at talesfromhollywoodland@gmail.com. We love to hear from our fans. If you have ideas for a show or a guest, please let us know. We also have a YouTube channel now. You just go to Google, type in YouTube, and Tales from Hollywoodland. Thank you, Scott, so much for being a part of this today.
Thank you, Joe.
Enjoyed it, Scott.
tune into the Dragon Con Report podcast, your ultimate destination for all things Dragon Con.
Join us each month as we dive into our home away from home and cover the world of con fandom, cosplay, gaming, and more.
With guests each show, behind the scenes insights, tips and tricks, and the latest updates on this year's convention.
Whether you're a seasoned attendee or a first-time explorer,
the Dragon Con Report is your passport to the ultimate geek experience.
Join us and let your inner dragon roar.
This has been a broadcast of the ESO Network. Be part of the crew and help support our shows by donating to our ESO Patreon or by shopping at the TeePublic store, which can all be found at www.esonetwork.com. The ESO Network, your station for all things geek.